Good morning, everyone, and thank you for joining us. I am joined with my colleague, Lauren McDade from Bravo. I'm going to give her some time to introduce herself to you all. So, Lauren.
Thank you, Courtney. I'm Lauren McDade. I'm the Victim Services Coordinator at Bravo, Buckeye Region Anti-Violence Organization. We work with lesbian, gay, bisexual, transgender, queer, and intersex survivors of relationship violence, sexual violence, stalking, and hate and bias violence.
Thank you, Lauren. And my name is Courtney Robinson. I am an outreach specialist with the Cleveland Rape Crisis Center. We serve survivors of sexual violence in Cuyahoga, Lake, Geauga, and Ashtabula County. We serve survivors in the area of therapeutic services, justice system advocacy, and we also have our 24-hour hotline as well. So thank you all for joining us, and that's a little bit about us. Today we're going to be discussing the topic of cultural competency, but before we get started with that, I think it would be good if we all had some background just to know where we were coming from. So I'm going to let Lauren kind of break it down for you a little bit about what we're going to be discussing.
Thanks. So like Courtney said, we're going to be talking about cultural competency as it relates to responses and prevention efforts on college campuses around gender-based violence. So gender-based violence includes all forms of violence and harassment that are committed against an individual and can include things such as sexual assault, rape, sexual harassment, and all forms of intimate partner abuse or intimate partner violence, as well as stalking. Gender-based violence impacts everyone. People of all gender identities, sexual orientations, race and ethnicities, socioeconomic statuses, education levels, ages, and abilities. It's therefore important that the services that we provide reflect this and are inclusive of all survivors.
Absolutely. This is a topic that Lauren and I both are very passionate about, and we wanted to kind of start with just a background just so everybody knew where we were coming from and when we say these words, what they mean. They're words that we hear thrown around a lot all the time, but we wanted to just kind of start with a baseline understanding of what we were discussing.
Absolutely. And I think with that, too, it's just important to have an understanding of just how prevalent this issue is on our campuses. All statistics and all studies around gender-based violence are underreported, but one study that came out in January of 2016 by the BJS found that 1 in 5 women and 1 in 6 men reported that they had experiences with sexual assault during their college career.
Wow.
Yeah, I mean, that's huge.
Mm-hmm.
Additionally, that study found that 22% of gay and lesbian students, 35% of bisexual students, and 28% of transgender students also reported experiences of sexual assault while in college.
Wow.
So absolutely, it's an epidemic and something that is happening on college campuses and something that really needs to be responded to. And I think we're really fortunate that here in Ohio that there is a lot of really great work happening on college campuses to respond to and to prevent gender-based violence.
And absolutely. And I feel that the campuses have a responsibility, like you said, to address these issues on their campus that are affecting their students. It's one thing for a student to have these academic challenges, but then there's also so much more outside the classroom that doesn't get discussed that affects what happens in the classroom. So to really be a whole university, you have to really support your students across the board in all their issues and struggles.
Absolutely.
Why do you feel that this is, and we've discussed it a little bit more, but maybe let's go in a little bit more detail about why this is so important for universities to really focus on this issue, or why has universities started discussing sexual violence prevention so much on campus?
So, yeah, I mean, I think that this is just really important for campuses, because when you really think about the prevention efforts and the response efforts that campuses are making, they're only going to be as effective as the scope of the students that they're reaching. So if you're only reaching a certain part of your campus, sure, those services might be somewhat helpful for them, but you're missing a large majority of the campus that, you know, is experiencing forms of gender-based violence and needs to know that the services that are out there are there for them as well. So I think it would be helpful to kind of just talk about what cultural competency is, because I think that there's a lot of talk about, like, yes, make your services culturally informed, make them culturally relevant, but, like, what does that actually mean and what does that actually look like? There's several definitions out there, so just to kind of go through some of them so we can see the commonalities in them. You know, some definitions of cultural competence talk about, you know, a set of behaviors or attitudes or policies that an individual or an organization holds. It's an ongoing process, which involves individuals and larger systems whose service or program is delivered in a way that respects and effectively responds to all people and cultures. So it's really looking at the behaviors and attitudes and policies that are held by individuals and that are held by systems.
Absolutely.
I think it would be helpful to go back and look at the different components of that definition. I think it's really important to view cultural competency as being an ongoing process.
Yeah, it's definitely not like some one and done. We did one program, fall semester, and that was it.
Right. Check it off the to-do list.
Yeah. It's a commitment.
Yeah, it absolutely is. It is a commitment. I think it's a commitment that all of us as individuals need to be taking on, as well as something that our campuses and the organizations that we're a part of also have a responsibility in, you know, creating opportunities for their staff to become more knowledgeable so that their services and the programs that are being provided are more informed and more accessible for all students.
Absolutely.
And also, too, I think just also recognizing that it can be an ongoing process as individuals to be examining our own implicit biases and our own privileges and the lens that we bring to the work that we're doing. And also recognizing that, you know, within communities, you know, best practice and language and things are always changing. I know, for instance, you know, in the work that I've done with the LGBTQI community, you know, there's a lot of change as far as what language the community uses for their sexual orientation and gender identity. So like the term, like the term queer, you know, certainly is something that's being used a lot more readily. Whereas, you know, over a decade ago, that might have been language that was not used as prevalently as it is today.
Yeah, and I think it just takes an effort to educate yourself, push yourself kind of out of your norm and stepping out of your box and finding out things about people who maybe identify outside of you or areas that you're not comfortable with, but it's more for the benefit of the greater community than your own personal discomfort.
Absolutely. Yeah, and so there's, you know, various models and ways to assess kind of where an individual or a program is as far as cultural competency readiness. And, you know, I know campuses do a lot of work to assess, like, you know, where are we as a campus and a community to wanting being able to respond to gender-based violence. And so, you know, I think it could be helpful to think about the way that campuses and individuals are along a continuum in informing the practices and services that communities or campuses are putting forth. So there's one model out there called the CROSS model of cultural competency, which looks at cultural competency along a continuum
where at one end you have cultural destructiveness, so kind of actions where culture and cultural identities are viewed as a problem, all the way to the other end of the continuum where there's advanced cultural competence, where it's something where individuals and agencies are really active in their allyship and doing kind of above and beyond to make sure that their efforts are accessible to all students on their campus and to make sure that the work that they do on an individual as well as a programmatic level are informed and accessible to all students on campus.
Right. And what are the six stages?
Yeah, so starting at one end, we have cultural destructiveness, and then it moves all the way up to advanced cultural competency. So at the one end, starting with cultural destructiveness and working, you know, towards advanced cultural competency, an organization or campus that's at the cultural destructiveness stage is someone or a campus that's going to view culture as being a problem and that cultures are something that should be stressed or suppressed, and that there's one culture that is superior to all other cultures. So kind of this whole, like, everyone should assimilate into the mainstream and leave aspects of their culture behind.
Mm-hmm.
Then the next level is cultural incapacity. So at this stage, individuals might lack cultural awareness and knowledge about making services and the work that they're doing culturally informed. They may also maintain and really believe stereotypes about various communities and identities, mm-hmm. and may take kind of like a condescending approach towards people with different or with other cultural backgrounds than themselves. So treating them with pity or feeling sorry for somebody whose cultural identity is different than their own. And gotcha. So at an organizational level, this could even look like, you know, segregation of services or segregation amongst the campus community.
Mm-hmm.
The third stage is cultural blindness. In this stage, individuals think that culture doesn't matter and that all people are the same regardless of someone's cultural identities. Therefore, services are kind of offered in a one-fits-all approach, and services and prevention messages aren't being informed by a survivor's or a community's cultural identities. And so, you know, in this stage, services really are only going to meet the needs of the community or identities in our culture that have the most power and the most privilege. And so folks from other communities are not having the needs met in a way that is culturally informed. It's really important that services and prevention messages are informed by the communities that a campus is hoping to connect with. You know, again, just going back to the fact that, you know, our efforts are only as helpful or as effective as we're able to reach. And so if we're putting messages out there, assuming that in this stage of cultural blindness, that there's a one-size-fits-all approach, our campuses are really missing a lot of the folks that they're trying to reach with their messages.
The next stage is cultural pre-competence. So we're starting to now see stages along the continuum where folks are taking actions to inform the work that they're doing and to make the services that they're providing more informed and more accessible to all folks on campus. So at the cultural pre-competence stage, you see individuals that are starting to recognize, like, hey, you know, there are a lot of different cultures and backgrounds, and it's important that we take steps to educate ourselves on the cultural backgrounds of folks that are on campus.
Mm-hmm.
And recognizing, like, hey, you know, maybe there are gaps in the services that we're providing and in the programs that we're providing. And these might be areas where we can use some of this knowledge to enhance the work that we're doing.
Yeah.
So, you know, this might look like at the organizational level where campuses are maybe hiring a diverse staff and maybe offering trainings for staff to become more informed on cultural backgrounds that are different from theirs and how that can relate to the work and the services that they're providing.
Right.
Then the fifth level is basic cultural competence. So at this level, individuals are valuing and respecting and accepting the diversity of the students and folks on their campus and are understanding that there's a lot of dynamics and intersections of various cultural backgrounds.
Right.
I think at this level, we're seeing campuses that are reaching out to communities in the either on campus or in the broader community to work collaboratively with maybe underserved or marginalized groups to help inform the work that they're doing.
Yeah. I think that this would be a good time to maybe do some self-reflection, maybe ask yourself, if I were to say, just walk into the student union of my institution, university, or college, and just ask the random student, where do they think that we would fall on that spectrum? Where do they think that we would land? If I were to ask a member of our faculty, of our staff, what would they say? What would our community partners say? I think that that would be a good way to kind of assess where you are, because you may think that you are on one level, but it might be perceived that you're at another one.
Now that we've spent some time talking about what cultural competency is and why it's so important. I'm going to turn it over to Courtney to share more about the importance of an anti-oppression framework and thinking about intersectionality when we're talking about gender-based violence and programming on campuses.
Thank you, Lauren. So just to give you a little background, when we say anti-oppression, what we really are meaning is the anti-oppression framework is a tool to see how people experience oppression in the world and a way for us to stop it. When we talk about anti-oppression, we're really focusing on naming oppression that happens against certain people based on their identities, and then working towards ending that mistreatment, that oppression, that violence towards that particular group. This is so important because in my research, when I was looking this up, a great exercise that I saw was for a college or a university to look at who is reporting on their campus. Look at the students that are reporting incidences of sexual violence on their campus, and then compare it to the percentage of your campus. So, for example, look at the percentage of maybe students who identify as LGBTQ versus the actual percentage on your campus. Or look at the percentage of people who identify as women of color versus the percentage of women of color on your campus. And what you'll find might shock you. What I've seen on a lot of campuses is the numbers aren't proportional, meaning they had a larger number of a certain group reporting and they were a smaller proportion of the population on campus. So I think it's important to include that in your work because this could be something that could be something that's targeted, something that you can use to inform your programming that you do on your campus. So when we're talking about anti-oppression, that's what we're talking about when it comes to your campuses.
I think that's a really great action step for campuses to take to look at kind of who's reporting, like you said, Courtney. You know, because I think one thing I've also heard is kind of based on some of the reporting, you know, folks might think, oh, well, we don't have like LGBTQ students or we don't have religious students on campus. But again, it's just because somebody is not coming forward and sharing their experiences doesn't mean that there aren't students on somebody's campus that are in need of support and help.
Absolutely. And the big thing that I've learned about college campuses is it's a sense of community. And you never want a part of your community to feel like they're not a part of the community or they can't access services or they're not being reached.
So, Courtney, can you share a little bit more about how oppression and sexual violence, how they're tied together?
Absolutely. So when a community accepts or when it's kind of like the social norm to have oppressive or harmful attitudes towards people who are maybe of certain races or classes or gender, etc., people who experience that marginalization because of those norms have less power. And we know that sexual violence is a power-based crime. So the violence that happens towards them is then normalized. And it's not only excused sometimes, but it becomes socially acceptable. So then we have this issue where marginalized groups are viewed as less credible and more accessible to those who have more access to power. So in terms of, and when I say sexual violence, I'm talking about things like harassment, rape, and other forms of violence kind of under that umbrella. So, and oftentimes what happens is marginalized communities are often blamed for the violence that's enacted against them. So it creates this environment where people are feeling like they're not supported, where people are feeling like they aren't going to be believed, and so they don't access services, so they don't feel supported, and it continues and it continues, and it creates this community where this becomes a social norm.
So kind of expanding upon the anti-oppression framework and how it relates to sexual violence, can you share more about intersectionality, you know, what it is and why it's important in the work that campuses are doing?
The intersectional approach recognizes that individuals who belong to certain marginalized identities or communities are disproportionately affected by sexual assault and harassment. And that may require different forms of support and accommodations. I think that this is important for universities to take that time to talk to their students to find out what's going on. We can't have blanket solutions because a blanket solution doesn't fit everyone. It's not going to work. Every situation is different. Everyone is coming to this situation with their own different experiences and situations.
It ties back to what we talked about earlier, thinking about the cultural competence continuum is that, you know, kind of in the middle there, there's that whole concept of everybody's the same, everyone can just get the same services. And again, it's like you said, there's not just one solution or response, that it's really important for campuses to be thinking about the unique needs of each and every single student. And so sometimes, and so that requires that there be space for bringing culture into the response, and also thinking about the intersections of folks' cultures. For instance, like all gay people are the same. You know, there's gay people of color, there's gay folks that might be international students or might also have a strong tie to religion. And so just how do you bring all the different facets of somebody's identity and use that? Because knowing that there can be strength in bringing that into the response. And I think also, like you were mentioning, making sure then that prevention efforts and programs are also reflective of those intersections as well. So like if you're doing programming for LGBTQ student group, for instance, recognizing that there's a lot of diversity within that group and just making sure that that's being reflected and taking into consideration in efforts on campus.
So that's it for the first podcast. Courtney and I have really enjoyed talking with you all today about the importance of cultural competency and how to make your services more accessible, and talking about anti-oppression and intersectionality. So stay tuned next time. Courtney and I will be talking a little bit more in depth about some of the obstacles and barriers that certain campus communities might face when trying to access services or access prevention messages. And we'll talk about some action steps that campuses can take to make their prevention efforts more accessible to their entire campus. Thanks, everyone.